Please welcome Tony Gervasi to tell us about capacity requirements for transporting analog over IP STLs. Note also that he happens to be a restaurateur and award-winning chef, a little tidbit I learned 37 seconds ago. Tony.
Good morning, everybody. I apologize for sounding the way I do. I landed this yesterday morning with this nasty fever and cold, but I couldn't miss this. So, Chris, how are you doing this morning? My name is Tony Gervasi. I'm from Gates Air. I'm the sales manager for Interplex. Thank you very much for coming out to the WBA. Is this thing working? There we go. Quick little background about myself, 30 years broadcast engineer, 18 years as senior VP of engineering for Nassau Broadcasting based out of Princeton, New Jersey. Senior member SBE, Microsoft certified, worked for Elanos for a little bit. Those are the guys who just acquired BE. And I joined Gates Air in April as a sales manager for Interplex. I've also been using Interplex since the early 90s. Just as Gates Air acquired them, or Harris acquired them. So what we're going to discuss in this presentation, we're going to analyze load generated by the encoder for transporting different signals across STL. In this case, transport audio, where the load can significantly vary depending on the format of the audio. Is it this mic that's causing the issue? Now testing. We'll look at the capacity requirements for both data rates and packet rates. And the idea is to analyze and understand the SLA or quality of the networks to use for particular case use. As you can tell here, we're talking about passing different types of audio, where it's AES-167 or composite, if you would, MPX, or just AES-3 across or analog across using the private line. We'll also have to look at overcoming network impairments, packet loss, jitter delay, and then, of course, the relation between packet loss and the techniques. Also want to take into a point real quick, and before we get any further, is I know it's often easy to point to our ISP to say they're the issue, they're causing our problem. Take a look inside first. I dealt with a client the other day who was having, he says, I've got this 200 meg pipe and it's great and I've got all this bandwidth and I'm losing all kinds of data, and we looked at his equipment. You know, he swore it was his Interplex gear. Come on, it's not. And we looked at it and I'm like, wow, what's your router? He's like, excuse me? I'm like, well, what's your router? Sonic wall we installed 15 years ago? Uh-huh. Did you check bandwidth on that? How much speed can you pass through this device? And then there was silence. I asked him to pull the model number up and look at the specs and tell me what he can pass. He may have a 200 meg pipe, but if you can only pass 50 meg through the box, well, yeah. And it happens a lot. Radio stations that use the, you know, I went to Home Depot or went to Staples and I bought the $16 four-port switch to run my IP STL at my transmitter site because I just needed something quick and dirty. And you want to know why your station keeps burping, you have packet loss and jitter and all that good stuff. So keep that in mind. While it's easy to point to the ISP, take a look at what you're using first just to move IP. I know it's much easier to do it when we're doing when we're doing audio over IP, whether it's the two big guys or three big guys or whatever they are, because that shows itself really quick when you're using a poor quality router or a poor quality switch. But in this case, when it comes to IP, I mean, when we do it in our office network with VoIP, you know, just we hear a little burp. If you're generating a web page, you're looking at webmail or email, it's just, okay, we ask for another packet. But when you do it for your STL, you know, like a T1 where you can't be half pregnant on a T1, it either works or it doesn't work. In the IP world, you can be half pregnant. So before we look at the requirements for various signal pipes, let's start out by understanding that the load generated by the encoder. Audio over IP is a real-time application, similar to those with VoIP and video over IP. We all use RDP and UDP protocol as the transport protocol. These applications contain bit rate and generate constant amount of packets out to the encoder at a constant packet size. Excuse me. So the total data rate for the stream and the number of packets per second, we count all of that, including our overhead. Packet rate part of the load can affect the performance of the network by the devices in the middle. And again, we're talking about who's, if you go running through Bob's ISP in between and Bob has a 15-year-old router, well, there you go, or switch or other equipment. is less taxing to process bigger packets at lower rates than similar packets at higher rates. This just has to do with the overhead. Packet rate is inversely proportional to the packet time size, or sometimes referred to as the packet interval or packetization delay. For a 1 millisecond packet time, we'll generate 1,000 packets per, and it contains 1 millisecond of audio segment holding 1 millisecond of audio. That makes sense? Sure. Packet rate is also proportional to the overall data rate. High packet rates will require higher data rates to packet overhead, and each packet must contain packet headers, which are the RTP, UDP, and IP protocols, which is about 40 bytes. So let's look at an example here real quick. If we're passing, that's what these are for. Too much NyQuil this last night. Let's look at the following example of uncompressed stream at 44.1 with 16-bit sample size. All right, if we look, you can see that we have the overhead is standard, 40 bytes. So with a 4 millisecond packet time, the encoder generates about 250 packets per second. Packet is half full at 745 bytes, assuming there's a 1500 byte MTU, which is about standard. The packet overhead is 5%, so this ratio of the size of the packet header to the size of the payload in each packet is about 1.5 meg. That's going to give you your 44.1 stereo. Compared to that, with an 8 millisecond packet time, where the packet rate is half, the standard of each packet is 1500 for MTU, and therefore the overhead is low. The bandwidth is about 500 kbs less because half the packet overhead rate. So the biggest difference between the two configurations is the additional 125 packets per second needed to process the overall by the devices in the middle, and the additional data rate. Well, for most networks, that's less of a concern. But again, when we're talking about systems that we're now starting to do this in older plants, or plants that haven't been updated in the last 3 years, where you're still running your circuit on DSL, this becomes an issue. What's the recommendation for second packet times? Well, with IP, it's configured by the user. As low as 1 millisecond is supported, but you want to make sure that your network design before selecting a low packet time. Our recommendation is to select the highest value, and which is limited to ensure the size of the packet does not exceed 1,500 bytes. There's also a relationship between packet time and effectiveness of forward error correction. Smaller packet times will require more columns of the 2D matrix to recover the burst times of packet loss. For example, to protect against 100 milliseconds of network error, you would need at least 25 columns if you're using 4 millisecond packets versus 4 columns with 25 millisecond packets. That's a huge difference. And since forward error correction requires additional network bandwidth, before using forward error correction and its sole technique to recover packet loss, the users need to consider matrix size to support of the codec. The packet time of the audio is most important for the patterns of the packet loss on the network using the analytics. So in other words, we have to look at not only how much information we're putting in for the packets going out, but also how much we're adding on top of that for the forward error correction and our total time. Here we're going to say compressed versus linear audio, whether we're using linear 48 at 200 seconds, at data rates 1.6 or 1.5. But then if you use Opus 128 at 200, 100, or 50, and look at your data rates, 200, 165, 145. And again, that's going to be with the overhead and using the UDP, RTP, and IP. And there are different data rates there for our packet sizes. Packet rates for ACC codecs can be further reduced by packeting multiple frames in the RTP payload. This increases the packet time of the audio. Higher packet rates also provide better tolerance to network jitter. In the IP links, the receive buffer is configured in the number of packets with the maximum of 512 per stream. So depending on the total packet time, this can translate to several minutes of buffering if you needed it. However, with higher packet times, each lost packet can have perceptual audio gaps. So you have to consider that in a trade-off as well. Bottom line is, if you're planning on using an unmanaged or public internet connection, compressed audio format may be best suited for it. Both packet rate and coding rate can be adjusted on the fly. Lower packet rates have less impact on network devices, and lower data rates allow for more capacity for user packet loss and packet protection.
Hi, Mom.
As mentioned earlier, in some cases, it's advantageous to support composite FM or MPX from your studio to transmitter site or studio to multiple transmitter sites, including your RDS and other SCAs if you're using that. This enables baseband equipment to be located at the studio site, so your audio processor and all that good stuff, where the engineers can keep it in the rack and keep it nice and warm and it's protected from all the lightning and all that good stuff. It also can save in CapEx when distributing to multiple transmitter sites for a main, auxiliary, tertiary site, especially if you're doing HD and you want to process your analog at your studio and run your E2X data to your transmitter sites. You could do that using the IP Connect through IPL. It finally simplifies single cast for SFN operations. I personally manage a 4-station SFN in Miami. This is exactly what we're doing. And the delay of the baseband processing is common to all sites, as opposed to measuring and compensating for each site location. Composite transport, MPX transport, does require higher STL capacities with a tighter SLA, typically found in managed ISPs or private networks. Though we happen to be running it across Comcast, and when it works great. When it's ornery, it's 2 weeks of fighting it. Here we're gonna look at different composite bandwidths, if you would. If you look at the sample rate, at 132, just running audio and RDS, at using 12 bits as your sample, we're able to get down to use 1.64 meg. So I think we're the only codec to go down that low. It's still higher than T1, but if you have a 5 meg circuit, that works great. As you can see, if you look across, sampling at 162 with RDS and 1 SCA, that same rate is 2.1. So if you figure if you're going to sync it somewhere, if you have a circuit that's going to give a download per location, somewhere around the 2, 2.5, you'll be good because you can sample all the way up if you wanted to. The 24, which is not really necessary. everybody's doing 16 or 20 on the sample and with your RDS, so you're going to be right around 2.2. You could change your packet rates. They vary anywhere between 200 and 500. And this applies to both AES 192 and analog. We can manipulate the algorithm in the 192 to actually get to the 1.64 using a 12-bit sample rate. So using inter versus intra ISP connection, So given more and more users are trying to use ISPs for their STLs, or as hopefully even as a backup path, we thought this would be useful. For example, at the studio site, close proximity, we can use from the ISP. It's much higher probability that we're using the one backbone through Comcast, or maybe one or two CO offices through Comcast that gives us a great SLA. Because we're staying with inside their network. In some cases, though, studio transmitter will need to subscribe to different ISPs, or you're doing multiple hops through multiple companies. The connection then and the peer relationship with both ISPs to carry a certain amount of overhead traffic between the two, and we might need to go through a transient ISP, which can be expensive, and this is a cost-wise for IP, not dollar-wise, can be expensive of sending the data through that circuit. Here, if we're looking at different transits, whether it's peering or we're looking through tier one into another ISP, X or Y, back into your system, I think doing all these ops has a cost to your data rate in your jitter and your packet loss and all of that good stuff. But regardless of how the STL is connected, it's going to be important that we have visibility to the performance. There's two reasons. One, we can analyze the performance of the network to employ a more effective either buffering or jitter rate conversion or forward error correction. And then we can also attract the SLA so we can prove to our ISP, here's what you're giving me. A perfect example was a situation in New Hampshire where at like 3 o'clock every Friday, a station was having a lot of just packet drops. They were in a community. They were in a condo community. What just happens, a lot of kids were coming home from school around then and lighting up their PS4s at the same time and cause. And it was true. I couldn't believe it. The cable company said, "Yeah, we're going to put you on a different circuit because we notice everything's getting choked when everyone connects to Sony or Xbox at that point." Thanks, kids. We have a tool called LiveLook that allows you to look in real time both ends of the circuit. It will give you the ability then to qualify and quantify your circuit, to show to your ISP, here's our jitter, here's our packet loss, here's what happens every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. The LiveLook also gives you the ability to, in its dashboard, it actually will make real time recommendations. It will say, "Hey, we're noticing that your jitter went up by 3%, and now you don't have packet loss, but you have packet staggering, and we may want to increase the buffer by another 15 milliseconds and go from 25% forward error correction to 50% forward error correction." It won't do it real time for you, but it'll make those suggestions in real time for you, and you can go in and change those. Again, that gives you then the ability to run a long-term report and hand it over to your ISP and go, "Hey, look what's going on." Here, this is the case of LiveLook for KCLM in LA. If you look at the top, where you can see the lost packets in the red, it jumps all the way up, and you have, 7.5, right? And then after we made our corrections with LiveLook, come on, kicking. Right, there's the green with the burst loss down below. So all this was happening through one ISP. And so we're going to see how much packet loss we have. And this was happening from 2 a.m. to 10 p.m. over the course of the day, operating day. And then if you look at bottom screen, you look at the green, that's their jitter. And their burst delay is in the yellow, where you can see there's a 500 milliseconds between peaks on that burst delay. And then a periodic packet loss. Which it looks like they were losing about 15 packets at a shot. Single network protection, packet protection. This is where we would deploy forward error correction. It can be used for isolated packet loss, typical for managed networks. If you're using a single public IP, like the one we saw in the earlier chart, we tend to see these burst packets, which is, for forward error correction alone, but it's not going to be, forward error correction by itself just won't be fully effective. In that case, there's an option to add diversity streams, whether it be parallel paths or time diversity. Duplicate packets are sent with a time offset, and the time offset is then programmed based on LiveLook to tell you, to take basically the guessing out, to tell you exactly how far you should set that diversity stream. And of course, we have multiple network protection. If you have the opportunity where you have two ISPs at your studio site and two ISPs out at your transmitter site, that gives you the ability to send both streams at the same time. They are mirrored copies of each other, but when they get to the studio transmitter end, they're then reassembled. So it's hitless operation. You don't hear it switch between the two. It actually marries everything and plays it right through. So with multiple networks, you could scale the protection by adding additional streams in the group with a combination of time diversity as well as network diversity and forward error correction. So that kind of gives you multiple layers of protection. And what makes this possible is the use of our advanced audio algorithm, which lowers the data rate, allowing the remaining network capacity to be used for protection. Thank you. I want to go back real quick to this one. This has come in handy a couple of times, especially in South Florida, where we have certain things called hurricanes that come through. And we find ourselves, we actually, in our particular device, the Interplex, we have three network ports that are native to every one of our boxes in the IPL series. So not only do we have a main and a secondary, but we also have a tertiary path. So in the particular case, in the stations that I'm running in South Florida, I have two ISPs leaving the studio, two ISPs out at the transmitter site. One's Comcast, one's AT&T, and they happen to be at all the locations. It's four transmitter sites. But our tertiary is actually a 4G modem from AT&T. And that's running Opus 192 across it. So in the case where we lose wire altogether, and we did last year during Irene, Florence, I think it was, one of those hurricanes that came through, we're at the studio. Downtown Miami was flooded. The studio had no connectivity whatsoever. Transmitter sites had no connectivity. Almirada was underwater down in the Keys. We ended up staying on the air by just running an AT&T 4G card and just running it to Opus. And it was a 50 gig card and never went past the limit. And it just ran. Sounded great, can't complain. And it still gave us a tertiary way to stay on the air immediately. And as soon as one circuit came back up, it switched right back over and continued on its happy way. It is possible on the AT&T 4G network to also run SFN the way we run it, because we time sync everything through GPSs in the Exciter as well as the path, that we actually kept our SFN completely synchronized while we were running across the AT&T 4G network. So just a neat little trick that we could do. Any questions? I know Chris, I saw Chris Tarr here earlier. Hey, Chris. Chris, you had the experience of installing these bad boys on your stations in here, right? Correct? In Milwaukee. And you're using both IP and STL? Sure. We can grab a mic over to Chris. Chris called and wanted a system design that he can run on both on a 950 link and the and our gear is IP basically on our 950, but also wanted a way to run it on traditional IP for backup. And
yeah, I had a unique situation where I had a T1 interplex system, an old one, and I was paying almost $1,000 a month for the point-to-point T1, which was ridiculous. So I wanted to get rid of that. However, that was my primary, and then I had a 950, an old 950 composite system as a backup. So I wanted to get rid of the T1 and the expenses related to that. However, I didn't want to just have one transport source. Plus, I had multiple channels of audio. I have an FM and an FM translator there, and I needed to send four channels of audio, left, right, for both of them up to that site. Plus pad data, all kinds of stuff. So what I ended up doing is I got their RF link transmitter, which in its basic configuration is just basically IP. And then I have, for redundancy, I have two IP link 200s. And so my essential configuration is I have a 950 link plus a very fairly inexpensive business DSL line as a return link and a redundant backup link. So the way that this system works now is, and ironically, as you were talking, I'm installing the feature keys. Some of this. But basically, my primary link is the audio and data over the 950 link, and then I have the DSL link as a return path, plus a redundant link for audio. So it's configured where I'm sending audio on both paths at the same time. And I've already tested it by switching transmitters on and off, and it really is instantaneous. I could tell just by a little change in the volume of the audio is all I could hear when it whirled from the 950 connection to the DSL connection. But it was one of those things that was very hard for me to give up because the T1 is so reliable, and it's a major market station, and I hate to have anything go wrong. And Tony just kept convincing me, you'll be fine, trust me. So we got it up, and it does. It works fantastic. And it's interesting. I actually have more bandwidth and more options available to me with this configuration than I did with the T1 and the time slots. Plus, because it's 950 and it's an uncongested area, and I can run the full data rate on it, I'm getting my music FM has uncompressed audio channels going up there. And I ran my talk station is running, I want to say, 256K AAC, which is just, they're just talk format. And I still have plenty of data for, all the pad data and everything else for HD and RDS to travel up that 950 link, which is, exceptionally reliable. And then the small cases where, we have issues or there's data dropouts, it can roll over to the 950. And even the even the HD or the RF link will do that as well.
Yeah.
So the RF link, if the RF link, if I lose the transmitter, it'll actually try to reconnect and pull the data up off of the DSL line. So there's all kinds of different ways that I have backups now. You know, either IP link to IP link directly, I can do it through the RF link, and I have an offsite or I have a second auxiliary site that I'm building, and I'm just going to put a second IP, the IP200, in the second place and mirror those channels.
Well, that's one of the good thing about when you're designing an IP system to do your backbone, no matter whose product you're using, if you have the ability then to send one source to multiple locations, whether it's be composite, you know you have the same quality of sound going to each location. You have the ability to send that to send data that goes with it, whether you leave your import or export at your studio and you're running E2X data through it. That keeps your timing aligned, by the way, by marrying the audio and your E2X data right through, and it's taking the same path right up. So that keeps it aligned all the way, so you don't have to worry about a third-party box chasing time alignment. That just now, we have to get used to that, but we also have to think in mind that weakest link. And in an IP world, there's always a weakest link. There's somebody else's equipment that you're relying on, whether it's you installed it 10 years ago and you forgot about it, or you know you didn't think about that $10 switch you bought at Staples, or you have to look at all of that information. So when you're designing your circuit, look at your entire backbone. I will also say, and Kurt can attest to this also, when you're buying infrastructure and you're buying cabling and wiring and RJ45 connectors and patch panels, don't cheap out. Don't go buy connectors from Alibaba and figure it, because I can't tell you how many radio stations have been burnt by bought a cheap $16, 48-port patch panel, and the tolerance on those connectors and those pins aren't the same as buying an expensive one or buying one that's made properly. Yes, I know your company's hounding you for CapEx, but do you want to be chasing your tail on a phantom problem? And you will. It will bite you. I've seen it in every market. Or just prevent it from the get-go. Same thing with RJ45 connectors. I know there's neat ones out there now that you actually feed the wire all the way through, and you cut through them, and the wire snips off. But what you got to be careful about is, because those wires now feed through that RJ45, it doesn't push into the connector all the way. It clicks, but just, ugh. And again, I've seen too many people, literally unwire an entire back office because of that, because they use these. Well, look how easy these are to put in. Take the time, do it right, label it, get the right equipment. Don't cheap out on your infrastructure. That will save you, whether it's audio over IP for your STL or whether you're using audio over IP through Wheatnet or Livewire. You don't want to cheap out on that stuff. And that's just years of my butt being burnt experience. Any other questions? Yes.
If you're using that solution with two ISP providers and splitting the path between the two and then reconverging it?
It's not splitting it. It's not splitting the data. Mm-hmm. It's actually duplicating the data.
Okay, so you're duplicating that data.
Yep.
What is a buffer size in case those two providers are completely different, like one's a WAN, the other's an ISP?
You will actually adjust the buffer size. If you're using stream splicing, which is our technology, once you marry those two streams, it automatically adjusts the buffer rate for you.
Okay.
So it will look at what's the longest latency and adjust the buffer on the shortest one to match.
Okay.
If you just want main and a backup where you're transmitting both at the same time and you're setting thresholds in the firmware where you can say, okay, if I see X amount of packet loss or X amount of jitter, switch over to the backup circuit, you can run them independent. But in stream splicing, once it marries on the other end, we'll adjust buffering automatically.
Another question. On that dashboard view, can you provide like that industry standard 900 second incremented SLA data that the ISPs like to see?
Yep, you can change this one. This is just running. This is our firmware. We're just doing data trapping. So we'll give you the MIBs. So if you're running, you're running into any type of traps, we can give you the MIBs. You can do what you want. Or yes, you can adjust the timing on this. I think down to 5. So you can adjust.
A lot of ISPs use 900 seconds, and then they adjust their billing accordingly. So if you have a big block of 900 second blocks that are bad, they'll actually credit you.
Really?
Yes.
How many people knew that?
They don't.
Oh, okay.
They say they will. And the third question, oh, never mind. You already answered that. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Have a great show. I'm going to go find a dock in a box now.